Welcome to You Bet Your Garden from WHYY in Philadelphia. Your host, Mike McGrath. Coming up later in the show, a listener wants to know about my experience of having worms turn my household kitchen garbage into beautiful, nutrient-rich casting. She has a regular bin, I got a tower, and she wants me to talk about the pros and cons of each. And we'll be doing that when we get to our wormy question of the week. Otherwise, it's a phone call show, cats and kittens, and you know what that means. We're going to take that heap and help into your telecommunicated questions, comments, tips, tricks, etc. at 1-888-346-9499. Josh, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hey, Mike, how are you?
I'm good, Josh. How are you, man?
I'm doing good. A little bit frozen right now in Woodstock, Georgia.
Woodstock. They have a Woodstock in Georgia now, huh?
We sure do.
All right. What can we do for Josh in Woodstock, Georgia?
Well, Mike, I got a hydrangea that my wife received not too long ago when she had surgery. You know, one of the ones that people get from the grocery store wrapped in the foil like you like so much.
Right, right.
When we got it, you know, I was trying to make sure, you know, I did everything right. And the blooms, you know, when we first got them, they were really pretty, and they seemed to dry out kind of quick.
Mm-hmm.
And I know that, you know, the hydrangea blooms do dry out, and you can, you know, cut them off or leave them on the plant. But this one seemed to be kind of doing it a little too quick. And so I just didn't know if maybe I wasn't watering it enough, you know, or if I wasn't maybe doing something correctly or maybe didn't have it in the right place in my house.
How long ago did you receive the plant?
Probably about 3 weeks ago.
Okay.
Is when we got it.
And yeah. How often have you been watering it?
I try to do it whenever I feel like the plant's gotten a little bit lighter. I take it out of the foil wrapper and let it soak for a little while until it gets kind of heavy again. Then I stick it back in it and then kind of wait till it looks like the soil has dried out a little bit at the top. And mm-hmm. then, you know, repeat if it feels like it needs to be. And I got it sitting in a window that gets morning light.
Right.
You know, it's currently indoors, so.
Well, you know, these things are forced, obviously, and they're meant to put on a good show there in the supermarket. And quite honestly, they don't care what happens to it after you get it back. Are you watering by letting the plant sit in water, or are you pouring water down onto the top of it?
Mostly just setting it down in like the sink and letting it sit in like a bowl of water.
Yeah, because that is the most successful way. That's the way you're going to really saturate it. My knowledge of the soils of these things like the poinsettias they sell and the little miniature roses is that soil has no organic matter in it whatsoever. And it seems to dry out like a shot, especially when we have our homes heated in the wintertime. Even though plants use less water in the winter time, you probably have an unhumid house and the humidity is wicking out into the atmosphere inside your house. So whenever that soil feels light, I would not hesitate to go let it sit in the sink for a good half hour, take it up through the drainage holes, put it back into place. And then if it feels light again 2 days later, I would not hesitate to redo that. I think the plant is humidifying your house is what's going on.
Okay.
Now, what's your long-term plan for this sucker?
Whenever the weather is a little bit nicer, I was going to try to put it outside somewhere like I've done with some of mine in the past. But those have never bloomed again. But I didn't have them for very long after I put them out there. So I don't know if I did that correctly. I was wanting to get that sort of advice from you to how, sort of when and where to put them in my yard.
As soon as you can work the soil in the springtime, I would take it out of its pot and I would plant it someplace. It gets decent sun, 6 hours of sun a day. It doesn't need to be protected where you are in Georgia. I realize you've had a colder, snowier a winter than you're used to, but that's a real anomaly. Plant it someplace where you'd like to see it, and as long as it develops new greenery, just leave it be. Don't feed it, because obviously it's been fed enough for 6 lifetimes already.
All right.
Do keep it well watered if you go through droughts. You know, put some compost on the surface of the soil around it, and as long as you get new green growth from it, by the time the cycle, the normal cycle, comes around next year, I see no reason you shouldn't see new blooms on that.
Okay.
All right. Good luck, Josh.
Thank you, Mike.
Thank you. Take care, man.
You too. Bye-bye.
1-888-346-9499. Francine, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hello, Mike.
Hello, Francine. How are you?
I'm very good, thank you. A bit cold, but good.
Yeah, well, there's a lot of that going around. And where is Francine very good?
I am near Philadelphia in Ardmore.
Okay, you have a wonderful accent. You don't sound like a Philadelphia native.
I try, but I can't hide it. I'm from France.
I don't think you can say athlete or attitude or go to the Acme on Roosevelt Boulevard. It would just...
No, I could say it, but nobody will understand.
It would just be wrong. What can we do for you?
So I have a front yard that I convert a little by little in a garden, and I have raised beds with different vegetables growing there.
Mm-hmm.
And I would like to have raspberries.
Okay.
So my question is, do I have enough space, and can I grow raspberries in a raised bed? So I have like a 16 feet by 4 feet against the brick wall of the house.
Right.
And it is southwest facing.
Oh, you don't have to worry about any of that stuff. First of all, raspberries don't need raised beds.
Okay.
Raspberries deliver the most and the most delicious fruits in the poorest soils. The only thing they need is good drainage. Typically, I try to get people to grow them at the outskirts of their property where the soil is rocky and poor. For some reason that I've never been able to really grasp, the plants that deliver the most delicious fruits, that contain the most phytonutrients, the best nutrition for us, tend to grow in the poorest soils with the least human attention or intervention. The only thing raspberries will need is a place to spread, because raspberries do not stay in the same place.
Yeah.
Now, you go out and you buy a blueberry bush, and you put that blueberry bush in very acid-rich soil, give it lots of sun. That bush will get larger over time and produce more blueberries, but it'll stay in the same place. Raspberries will walk all over your yard. Here's how it works. The first year, in the spring, you will either go somewhere and you will buy raspberry canes, or do you know anybody who has raspberries?
Well, we just have a new neighbor who told me she wants to transplant her raspberries from her old place.
Excellent. So you'll take a ride with her. You'll go to the old place and you'll take a bucket. And in the spring, what happens is new shoots come out of the ground. Those are the plants you want, the little baby green shoots.
Mm-hmm.
And you dig those up with as much of the root attached as possible. You take them back. You put them in an area that you've kind of cleared. You don't have to go to a lot of trouble. Again, not a raised bed, because they won't stay in it anyway.
Okay.
And then you plant these little green shoots, and you keep them watered for the first couple weeks if we don't get rain. And then after that, they're going to do fine. Now, there's two kinds of raspberries. There are raspberries that deliver small amounts of fruit all year long.
Mm-hmm.
But most of the old school raspberries deliver two crops.
Mm-hmm.
So if her raspberries are like mine, like Heritage, what will happen is that little green shoot will get very long over the course of the summer.
Uh-huh.
And then at the end of this summer, at the end of this year, it will develop a cluster of raspberries at the end.
Oh, great.
At the very tip that you will get to enjoy and eat. So you get pretty much instant gratification. Then people will tell you to cut the canes down to the ground, and those people are fools. What you do is, after your raspberries are finished, or after, you know, frost ends the season, just go out with a pair of pruners and just clip off the very tip of the plants where the raspberries were. And then the canes will turn brown and they will appear dead over winter. But in the spring, when the new shoots come up out of the ground, these old canes will green up and they'll send out shoots all up and down their length, and they will produce huge amounts of raspberries in early June.
Oh, wow. Okay, I didn't know that.
So
oh,
after that second harvest, those canes are done.
Okay.
They won't produce again. But you will have new green canes shooting up all over the area. Again, those will produce a cluster at the end of the season. And then the following year, they'll give you that bigger harvest very early in the spring. So, and that cycle will repeat itself until finally, after a very short period of time, 3 or 4 years, you'll be picking gallons of raspberries, especially that first pick in the late spring, early summer.
Wow, that sounds perfect.
All right, Francine?
Great. Thank you very much, Mike.
Well, thank you. Raspberries are one of my favorite things.
Great.
You take care.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Well, it's time for me to take a little break and announce that the famed Philadelphia Flower Show opens March 1st and runs through March 9th at the Pennsylvania Convention Center in downtown Philadelphia, and that I will deliver my annual Words of Wisdom at 7 p.m. on Wednesday, March 5th this year in the Gardener's Studio right there on the show floor. But don't go looking for all the details at the events section of our website just yet, because we'll be right back with lots more of your fabulous phone calls and the joys of having worms turn your kitchen garbage into garden gold. I'm Mike McGrath, and this is You Bet Your Garden from WHYY in Philadelphia.
Burpee supports You Bet Your Garden and offers over 70 new varieties for the 2014 growing season, including Steakhouse, a 3-pound plus beefsteak tomato, and On Deck, a sweet corn you can grow in a container. These and more can be seen online at burpee.com.
Welcome back to You Bet Your Garden from WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm your host, Mike McGrath. Coming up later in the show, red worms are great at turning your otherwise worthless kitchen waste into garden gold. But should you house your wormies in a bin, or should you be like Mike and have a tower, a veritable condo of worms stacked on top of each other? We'll take a look at both systems when we get to the question of the week. Otherwise, it's a phone call show, cats and kittens, and you know what that means. We're taking that heap and helping at 1-888-346-9499. Kate, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hi, Mike. Thanks for taking my call.
Well, thank you for making it, Kate. Where are you?
I am in Dayton, Ohio.
Excellent. What can we do for Kate in Dayton?
Well, my husband and I love to garden our small flower beds out front, and he has started bringing coffee grounds home in 5-gallon buckets. And I just wondered if there was too much of a good thing, because we're getting, you know, over an inch of coffee grounds spread on these beds as, you know, fall and winter progresses. So I just wondered what your thought was. Is there too much coffee grounds, or should he just keep bringing them home?
they look like soil, don't they? They look like nice finished compost when they're just sitting in that bag or that bucket. And there's no such thing as too much compost. But there can be very quickly such a thing as too many coffee grounds. Coffee grounds are one of the most valuable pieces of kitchen detritus that people tend to throw away. There is a tremendous amount of plant nutrition in them, but it is very tricky. Coffee grounds are not neutral in any sense of the word. First, they're highly acidic, so they should never be spread on a garden area that has, quote, normal plants on it. Coffee grounds would be highly beneficial when applied to blueberries at the right time of year, azaleas at the right time of year, rhododendrons, camellias. My favorite use for coffee grounds is you bring home as many as you can, you store them, and then in the fall, you shred up as many leaves as you can. You mix those two things together, and you make super premium compost that is not neither acidic nor alkaline, that is a great plant food.
Okay, can I ask you this? Like in Dayton, we actually have alkaline soil, so hopefully we didn't do too much damage to our beds. But we have a leaf mulch program through our town, so
right.
If we just put the leaf mulch on in the spring and sort of turned the soil, do you think that would be okay?
Combining the coffee grounds and the leaves right at the site of gardening is kind of dicey. Again, the best is to combine the two of them together, let them turn into one thing, and then you've got the perfect soil amendment. Because the other thing about coffee grounds is they are all nitrogen, like horse manure, like poultry manure. They're very nitrogen rich, and they don't have a lot of the fruiting and rooting nutrients. So, for instance, were you to level out the acidity, say you mixed in a little lime or wood ash to make that part neutral, and then you piled your coffee grounds around tomato plants, it would be the same as using horse manure. You would get these 50-foot tall tomato plants with two tomatoes on them. Because nitrogen causes plant growth. It helps the plant grow more biomass. But at the expense of flowering, a lot of nitrogen in the soil will inhibit flowering, which is why you want a balanced nutrients for your plants. So because they can inhibit flowering, because they are highly acidic, as you can see, there's a very tiny window in which coffee grounds can be used alone. But once you mix them with shredded leaves, they will accelerate the composting process. There's literally no better combination to make compost than, say, a 4-cubic-foot square of shredded leaves with a couple of 5-gallon buckets of coffee grounds mixed in. That will become super premium compost, super fast. The nitrogen in the coffee will feed the microorganisms that transform the leaves into super soil. And at the end result, you get something that is a complete plant food that'll grow good plants with lots of flowers, and it won't affect the acidity or the alkalinity of your soil.
Okay. So with our flower beds, if we're noticing that the plants are failing in there, we should probably get our soil tested and amend whatever the coffee has done to the beds.
Right, because adjusting alkalinity upwards is relatively easy. You can use agricultural lime, or you can use ashes from a hardwood stove, if you know anybody who burns wood for heat. Mixing a little bit of ash into, but just a little bit goes a long way. When I do this, for instance, I'll have a 5-gallon bucket of coffee grounds. I'll mix in maybe a pint of wood ash to level out the alkalinity. But then again, you've still got a heavy duty nitrogen fertilizer. That'd be good for lawns and trees, things that you don't want to flower. But by mixing it with the leaves, compost happens. Compost is good for all your plants.
Very good. Well, we're on the right track now.
Excellent.
Thank you. Sounds good. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. 1-888-346-9499. Paul, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Thank you.
Well, Paul, nice to talk to you.
Good to be talked to.
I hear that. Where are you, man?
Warriors Mark, Pennsylvania.
And where is that?
About 20 miles southeast of State College.
Another one of these State College people. Man, you are great public radio listeners out there. We get a lot of calls from the State College area.
Yeah, enjoy your program.
All right. Thank you, sir. All right. What can we do for Paul just outside of State College?
Okay, I've got about 3 acres of mostly wooded property, but I have a chunk down front by the highway that I use for lawn. It's only about 600 by 300, maybe. But on it, next to the highway, are 3 very large walnut trees. And I feel fortunate that I have grass there because I've tried to grow most anything there, and the walnut trees kill everything. The only thing I've been able to grow is mountain fern, and they get to be about 4 or 5 feet high.
Hmm.
But I've planted Colorado blue spruce, and I planted 19 of them several years ago. I've lived here for 50 years. And in the rest of the property, they're about 50 feet high. But the 4 that I planted down front by these walnut trees, they're all gone but one, and they just didn't grow at all.
Okay, so when we talk about black walnuts, we have 3 things happening. The first is the obvious one that most people know about, and that is that every part of the black walnut tree, but especially the root system, contains a naturally occurring compound called juglone that has a very negative effect on some other plants, because as you'll see, there are plants that will grow right next to a black walnut in the woods. My escaped ornamental wine berries, for instance, I often find big clusters of them next to black walnuts in the woods. Tomatoes and most garden crops, on the other hand, will keel over if they're within 150 feet of a black walnut. Now, but what people also don't take into account sometimes is how much shade are these full-grown trees casting, and how much competition for food and water are their roots putting out? And there are trees that will grow near black walnuts, but to get a tree established, as you know, it has to have a lot of sun and a lot of access to water and nutrients its first couple of years. Can it get that around these trees?
Well, there's a good bit of sun there, yeah.
Well, I have very good news for you. This subject has been heavily researched. Over the years, lists have been developed, plant lists. So I want you to go online, go to youbetyourgarden.org, and right at the top of the page, there's a link that says Garden Answers A to Z. Go to B for black walnut. Go to the articles on black walnut, and there are links in there to exhaustive lists of plants that will grow within the drip line of a black walnut and plants that won't. You'll find lists of wildflowers, perennials, ornamentals.
That's what I'm interested in. I wouldn't garden down there. First place is too close to highway. I probably wouldn't get anything off a garden anyhow.
But you'll be surprised. You'll be pleasantly surprised to see the number of things you can grow. And luckily, because of all the research that's been done, you don't have to reinvent the wheel. You don't have to do trial and error. Go through that list. Check off the plants that you think appeal to you. See what's available locally. And again, as long as they can get enough sunlight, the trees won't harm them.
Very good.
All right, man?
Appreciate that.
All right.
Thank
you. Good luck, Paul.
Thanks.
1-888-346-9499. Laurie, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hello.
Hello, Laurie. How are you?
I'm great, thank you.
Very good. And where is Laurie great?
I'm in Dallas Center, Iowa, just about 20 miles northwest of Des Moines.
Okay, what can we do for Laurie in Iowa?
Well, I live on an acreage. I have about 50 acres, and I have 2 3-acre runoff fed ponds that are absolutely beautiful. They're the water is perfect in them. We have 4 or 5 different species of fish. We swim in them. The wildlife loves these ponds. And we take good care of them. We're careful about what runs into them, as careful as you can be in agricultural land. But we have a neighbor who built a house whose land is contiguous to our pond. And as you know, when they build houses, they like to take all of the runoff from a house and tile it away from the house. So they've tiled all of this, and it runs through a culvert that runs right onto our property and about 200 feet away from the pond. So in anticipation of this, we let all the grass grow in between the culvert and the pond. But this spring, we anticipate that he will start to build his lawn. Right now it's been barren ground. I'm curious about what you might tell me about what we could possibly ask him to do to limit the amount of chemicals and such that he puts on his new lawn. I'd like to be proactive about it. Clearly, we spent a lot of time getting our ponds well-established, and I'd like to keep them that way.
Well, it's really interesting because the advice I'm going to give you comes from a kind of a local boy. Our premier lawn care advisor is Dr. Nick Christians, who is a turf grass specialist at Iowa State University.
Oh.
And he is the one who has said, first of all, especially in a harsh northern climate like yours, that any lawn that is trying to establish by seed in the spring will fail. So
okay.
The time to establish a new cool season lawn in Iowa would be around mid-August. Anything
okay.
he does now will just cause tremendous amounts of erosion. He might throw tons of chemicals on it trying to, like, fight what nature wants to do. But if somebody can sit down and explain to him the actual timing of establishing the right kind of lawn, that could save you a lot of misery. Because once the lawn is established at the correct time of year, then it gets by with 2 gentle feedings a year, one in the spring, one in the fall, especially if they use a mulching lawnmower that returns the pulverized clippings to the lawn. These are great big expanses of living plant material that absorb carbon dioxide, that manage stormwater and rainwater brilliantly. They shove oxygen into the air. They are great soft places to roll around on with dogs and children. And the big lie is they never needed chemical inputs. They need to be installed at the right time of year, which is spring, if you're putting in a warm season grass down south, or early fall if you're putting in a cool season grass up north. And then 2 gentle feedings a year and returning the clippings to the lawn is all any lawn needs. The feeding should not be chemicals. The lawns don't need chemicals. The chemicals just build up in the soil and run off, and they would ruin the water quality of your ponds. And did they go through all the proper zoning so that they can run this pipe that comes so close to your house and everything?
Yes. It's a long story, but we actually hired an engineer on our behalf to make sure that, you know, they weren't doing things that would damage not just our land, but our ponds, too.
Oh, okay. So you've already taken as many steps as you can. What I would do is plan to establish some large plantings around your pond, things like ornamental grasses that can use up, that can store up some of those lawn chemicals before they can get to the water.
We have that, and we have riparian barriers around all of the ponds for that very reason. Plus, we've put up some bales of straw to sort of slow down when we have these gully washers, to slow down the flow and avoid some erosion.
Right, and it sounds like you've planned this out as best you can. The only thing I can suggest is that you have a running dialogue with this person. Don't let them become an enemy. so that you can approach them and maybe guide them sustainably and help out both you and them.
Well, that's my plan, and that was the purpose of my call, is because they get to a beautiful view of our pond, and I'd like to remind them of how pretty it is to look at that beautiful pond every day and how awful it would be to look at it when it's not functioning quite the same way.
As soon as the weather breaks, invite them over, set up some little tables outside, maybe do a little early grilling, maybe have a little cocktail hour by the ponds, and get them down there talking about how beautiful it is.
I got it.
All right.
Sounds like a great plan. I can't wait for that.
All right. Well, we wish you luck. And like I said, make friends, because they're going to be there probably for a long time.
They will indeed. Thank you very much for your advice.
All right. Good luck, Lori.
Bye-bye.
Well, it's time to take a little break and announce that I will be one of the special guests at the 10th annual edition of Guess Who's Coming to Dinner, a fundraiser for the Philadelphia area community of Mount Airy at the historic Sedgwick Theater on Saturday evening, March 14th. But don't go looking for all the details at the events section of our website just yet, because we'll be right back with more of your fabulous phone calls and how to bring some worms into your life. I'm Wormy Mike McGrath, and this is You Bet Your Garden from WHYY in Philadelphia.
Burpee supports You Bet Your Garden and offers over 70 new varieties for the 2014 growing season, including Steakhouse, a 3-pound-plus beefsteak tomato, and On Deck, a sweet corn you can grow in a container. These and more can be seen online at burpee.com.
Welcome back to You Bet Your Garden from WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm your host, Mike McGrath, and we're in the stretch now, cats and kittens. In just a little bit, we'll get to the question of the week. Exactly how to get worms to process your kitchen waste into that great fertilizer known as worm castings. Should you build your worms a condo? Would they do well in a bin? We'll discuss all your options after a couple more of your fascinating phone calls at 1-888-346-9499. Rob, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hey, Mike, how you doing?
I'm doing fine. Rob, how are you?
I'm good. I'm out in Claymont, Delaware.
Okay.
And I have all raised beds, raised bed gardens, and I took down a tree, and I stuck some firewood along my back fence. And I ended up seeing these big holes in two of my beds. So I called a friend of mine who's an exterminator, so we dropped some poison down in there
got
rid of the problem. So I'm wondering, do I need to empty out all two beds and start over again?
Now, why did you... Well, first of all, you realize the mistake you made, that anytime you stack firewood against a house, it can become the rat motel.
Yeah.
You know, especially in a cold winter like this. Poison is never the answer. You could have done tremendous damage. I mean, in Claymont, Delaware, you have hawks and owls. What if a hawk or an owl or, God forbid, an eagle finds a poisoned rat? I mean, you are then insuring the lives of hundreds, perhaps thousands of vermin over the course of time. If you had gone to our website, if you had looked under R for rats, you would have seen the best answer is to simply trap them. And now they have these great battery-operated electronic traps where the rat goes in because they like to go into those closed little areas, gets electrocuted very quickly and humanely, and then a little signal light goes on to even tell you.
Oh, wow.
So
I had no idea. And this guy's an exterminator.
Well, yeah, he's old school exterminator. He's got to get up with the times because these poisons are causing tremendous environmental problems, you know, not to mention you could easily have knocked out somebody's cat, too, as well. Anytime you have vermin problems, the answer is trapping. It's never poisoning.
Yeah. So I don't know. I guess I should empty out those two beds and just put fresh soil in, I'm thinking.
Well, I don't know. Can you somehow, get the poison out of there? You used a bait that's like in little bricks or blocks, right?
Yeah, it was in little bricks. And they disappear. He told me drop them in, and when they disappear, you're okay. You know, then drop a couple of more, and if they're still there, then you got the problem away. So the problem was taken away, so I went in, pulled out the extra packs that were still laying there, and put them in a jar.
Okay, okay.
So I'm thinking I need to change the soil, because I'm kind of lost. I don't know which way to go.
Okay.
Should I just empty my raised beds and start over?
First of all, you're going to promise me you're never going to panic and use poison again.
Oh, no, I wouldn't.
And you're going to dispose of your leftovers properly.
Yes.
Did you wear gloves when handling this material?
Yes, sir.
Okay, good. Continue to wear gloves. So we hear some beeping noise. Are you at work, pal?
Yes, I am.
Okay, good.
So you hear some in machinery.
Good. We want our listeners to have steady jobs so they can become members during pledge drive time. All right.
Yeah, I'm a member.
Excellent. Excellent. Good. Keep working. We need we need those pledge drive dollars.
Okay.
So, the rat poison you use, the old school rat poison is warfarin, a blood thinner that some humans take as medication, but it affects rodents differently, and they're very sensitive to it. Now, over time, rats and mice have become resistant to warfarin, so they have created kind of new age poisons. I believe that they are still based on the blood thinner mechanism. So you don't have arsenic or lead, and by the packaging, you should be able to identify what you did have. And a little bit of research, or it may be even on the package, it may identify itself as an anticoagulant. It prevents blood from coagulating, which, again, for some medical conditions is essential in people. But for hundreds of years, it's been an effective poison against vermin. So the bottom line is I think you're okay.
Okay.
Just fill in those holes you made with good soil. Don't use any poisons from this moment forward.
And, no, I wouldn't.
And you can make up for this by becoming an ambassador. If you hear somebody say they've got rats or mice, you jump in and tell them about the new traps that are the bee's knees and not to use poison.
Yes, sir, I will.
All right?
Okay, Mike.
You are officially deputized. Go forth and do good.
Okay, thanks.
All right, take care, pal.
All right, bye-bye.
1-888-346-9499. Andreas, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Welcome to you, Mike.
Well, how are you, sir?
I'm fine. I am in the U.S. Virgin Islands.
Oh, okay. So what can we do for you, sir?
Well, as you are probably very well aware of, we have in our part of the world a lot of problems with mealybugs.
Oh, mealybugs, yes.
Yeah. They're wonderful animals. You look under each leaf, and the leaves are white from below.
Mm-hmm.
They're sitting there by the thousands, and they're eating away.
And what are they eating specifically?
They very much like hibiscus and bougainvilleas and some of these things.
Right.
They are very difficult to get rid of. And, of course, the old-timers here on the island that experience them for as long as they live, you ask 10 people and you're getting 10 different answers what to do.
The ornamentals you described are beautiful tropical plants, and
right.
these are in your garden. Do you do you feed these plants anything?
Very seldom, to be honest.
And what do you use when you use the seldom feeding?
I maybe give them fertilizer, I say, 3 times a year at best.
Yes, but what kind
of... And then I take just any variety of fertilizer. I'm not experience in this thing at all.
Okay. Your problem is easily solved. Your fertilizer is calling the mealybugs to your plants.
Mm-hmm.
In the tropics, where things just grow so naturally and so lushly, to add chemical fertilizer to a plant, it doesn't know what to do with it. It makes the plant grow even faster and more lushly. And it weakens the plant rather than strengthens it. So when you have a pest like a mealybug, it will always go for the plant that's been artificially fertilized first. So it's real simple to avoid them if you just don't feed your plants and you know there's the best hibiscus is growing out in abandoned fields, right?
Yeah.
Nobody feeding it. It's growing to the size of a tree covered with flowers. So stop the chemical feeding. If there's a way for you to get some nice compost, some good quality topsoil, don't be afraid to put that around your plants. But stop with the chemical feeding, and immediately the problem will begin to be lessened. Now, do you have pressurized water and a hose?
Yes. Well, it's available.
Right. So what I want you to do is every other morning, as early as you can, I want you to go out and I want you to pick an area that has mealybugs. And I want you to get that nozzle to where it's a really sharp stream of water, like a laser beam.
Yeah.
And I want you to cradle the plant in one hand and I want you to shoot the mealybugs off with the stream of water using your other hand. This will give you what's called a good knockdown. It'll kill most of them. It'll also be emotionally satisfying. When we do this, for instance, in Philadelphia, we are talking to the mealybugs. We are letting them know they came to the wrong garden, that they that this is the end they deserve, and it's too good for them, and maybe we'll step on one or two for good measure. So every other day, go out and pick another section and knock them down. Also, as much as possible, really get that chemical fertilizer out of your soil just by rinsing it out with water. Don't go crazy, but when you do this, let some more water go. Let those chemicals get away from the roots of your plants, and you follow this regimen of every other day or every couple of days, knocking them off in the morning, and then once we get to like a year without chemical fertilizer, the mealybugs will have moved on to your neighbor's plants.
Believe it or not, what I read on the internet, and that was from some botanical society out of the UK, they recommended that as first line of defense, hard water. I mean, strong water stream.
Just what I said.
Just what you said.
There you go. Great minds think alike.
You know... Number two was to use 50% of just normal dishwashing detergent and 50% of water.
Okay, now you can't do that. Don't forget, this is gardening advice from the United Kingdom.
Yeah.
Where there is no sunshine.
Yeah.
So soap sprays are much safer there. In the tropics, with the sunshine that gave me nice color in the middle of winter. You have to be very careful with soap sprays because they can harm your plants.
Well, I learned that the hard way.
Oh, okay.
So I did this on one plant, one of my pride and joy, which was a desert rose.
Mm-hmm.
Beautiful, which I nursed for at least 10 years. And I think I killed it in 2 days.
Yeah, so don't do that again. They're right on target with the sharp streams of water. Stop using chemical fertilizer. Be patient, and your garden will be pest-free in a year.
Well, thank you so much for your advice, and I will follow it.
Okay, very good.
Thank you so much.
Bye-bye.
Yeah, bye.
All right, as promised, it's time for the question of the week. Let worms turn your trash into treasure. Alexis Landis, producer of You Bet Your Garden, would you read this week's Wiggly question, please?
Sure, Mike. Sue in Detroit writes, "You've mentioned on the show that you are vermicomposting. Me too. I made my own bins from large plastic totes, and they work well. My only complaint is that separating out the finished compost is time-consuming and tedious. You've said that you use a stackable worm factory for this very reason. Do you find that it makes it easier to harvest the finished compost? Do the worms really crawl up from the finished trays into the next higher tray? Do you have a problem with escapees? And finally, how do you store the compost produced in the winter? I would love to hear a segment about your vermicomposting. And thanks for all the wonderful shows you already do. I listen to your podcast every week."
Well, thank you, Sue. I've had my worm factory for a little over 2 years, and it's been a real blessing, especially in the winter. In the summer, I can just carry our compost crock out to one of my sealed black plastic bins, dump it in, add a lot of shredded leaves, and be done. But easy access to those bins often becomes perilously difficult in the winter, especially when we get a wretched one like this year. So I used to keep a galvanized metal slop bucket with a locking lid outside, fill it with kitchen garbage, and then try and mix it into one of my compost bins with big batches of shredded leaves I'd hoarded for that purpose. I broke the bottoms of 3 different slop cans trying to bang those frozen garbage sculptures of R2-D2 out in the middle of winter. And then the frozen chunk of muck would just sit there like a rock in the middle of the pile until June.
But why do you even bother? You always say that most kitchen garbage doesn't contain enough potential nutrition to improve the finished compost very much.
That's true. Only coffee grounds and eggshells really perk up the mix in an outdoor pile. But you can't, or shouldn't, throw away all that other kitchen waste. The essence of a sustainable landscape is to reuse as much organic matter as possible. And I knew that specialized red worms could turn that mostly worthless compost waste into a super premium plant food. One author of a paper on the staggering increase in nutrients that occurs when garbage is processed by red wigglers concluded, "Something wonderful happens in the gut of a worm." So I abandoned my winter garbage can dance and ordered up a worm tower, specifically for the very first reason our listener brought up.
Which was?
The separation of the finished product, more properly called worm castings than compost, from the stuff that's still pretty raw. In a single bin system like she has, you're supposed to have lanes you can manage. The first lane in, say, a big Rubbermaid bin that you've equipped with some kind of drainage system would be a layer of garbage covered by damp shredded newspaper and then damp sheets of newspaper. Then, when you have more garbage to add, you make another lane next to it and so on. When you put in the final lane of fresh kitchen waste and dampened paper, your hope is that the worms will have finished with the first lane and moved over to the side with the fresher stuff.
And your tower uses stackable trays instead of lanes?
Right. It's a pre-made contraption with stackable perforated trays, a solid bottom that funnels the worm tea into a spigot, and a lid to keep light and flies out. You fill the bottom of a tray with fresh garbage, cover it with lots of shredded newspaper, wet it down, put a few sheets of damp newsprint over top of that, and put the cover back on. Then you keep filling trays as the need arises, always putting the freshest material on top.
And the worms really move up?
Yeah, they'll keep working finished material if that's all they have, but they really seem to prefer fresh garbage. And they start moving up as soon as I put a new tray in place. And they don't seem to have any trouble climbing. The trays are designed to make upward mobility easier.
Now, what about escapees?
Oh, come on. I've never had a loose worm. I do see the occasional worm when I lift the top cover, and I have had to rescue the occasional swimmer from the wonderful worm tea reservoir at the bottom. But no worms have ever tried to make a break for it. They want to stay in that dark, moist, food-rich environment.
And what exactly do you do when a tray is finished?
Well, there's always a few worms still working in even the most finished tray. So first, I'll pick out as many of them as I can and toss them back into the bin. Then, if it's summertime, I'll empty the contents of the tray at the base of one of my fruit trees or split it up between a few tomato and pepper plants. In the winter, I dump finished trays into one of my sealed black compost bins outside, where the worm castings will make my already excellent outside compost super excellent. Well, that sure was an interesting look at worm wrangling now, wasn't it? Luckily for you, the question of the week appears in print at the Gardens Alive website. To read it over in detail, just click the link for the question of the week at our website, youbetyourgarden.org. Gardens Alive supports the You Bet Your Garden question of the week. Yikes! My producer is threatening to set my worms free if I don't get out of this studio. Don't do that. It's too cold for them. We must be out of time. But you can call us anytime at 1-888-346-9499 or send us your email, you're tired, you're poor, you're wretched, refuse teeming towards our garden shore at garden@whyy.org. Please, please tell us where you live. Please, please. And visit our website, youbetyourgarden.org, where you'll find answers to all your garden questions, audio of this show, past shows, and our podcast. Elizabeth Perez Luna is executive producer of audio content for WHYY. Ken Queter plays our theme song. Our engineer this week is Hungry Al Banks. Rich Banowitz and Sarah Kazar are You Bet Your Garden's internet illuminators. Our social media director is Amanda McGrath. Check out her fine work at the You Bet Your Garden Facebook page. Our editor is Al Banks. Alexis Landis produces You Bet Your Garden for WHYY-FM in Philadelphia. We continue to welcome our new production assistant, Marissa Nicosia. Nicosia, Nicosia! To the show. I'm your wormy host, Mike McGrath, and I'll chow through all these leftovers in time to see you again next week. This miserable winter will soon just be a memory, and finally our attention will be turned from shoveling to growing. I'm Mike McGrath, and on the next thrilling episode of You Bet Your Garden, I'll discuss how to care for your lawn sustainably, and in many areas, legally, plus your fabulous phone calls.